Warmest welcomes to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, the speaker is Don Brandt. He will be addressing cultural challenges to the family. So now let's listen in on Don Brandt.
The overall theme for the week is parenting in the 90s, and so it's not a parenting techniques course, but rather a look at how cultural trends in the 90s are impacting the family. And in particular, as we progress in the course, we're going to be looking at the issue of teaching values to our children, given the current cultural realities in the United States. Why don't we begin with a word of prayer. Lord, as we consider this most important issue of family life and parenting and the raising of children that would come to know you as Lord and Savior, we ask for your inspiration and your guidance so that all that we do might be to the honor of your name. We pray for this in Christ's name. Amen. The only credentials I have, the only reason actually I asked to teach this course, my expertise is the course I taught last week, so if you missed that, then you're a... This week is actually going to be much more of a discussion-oriented course than what I did last week. Last week I did evangelism, which is my line when it comes to the ministry that I'm involved in. But I wanted to do a course on parenting and cultural realities in the 90s, partly because I'm working on a book on it, so I've had a lot of time to research it over the last 6 months. But primarily simply because I'm a father of three, rather obsessive father of three, and then a pastor and a Christian who has spent a lot of time simply reflecting on the challenges that we have before us, which I think are perhaps even greater than the challenges that might have been before parents 30 or 40 years ago, if in fact they are Christian parents hoping to transmit their faith to the next generation. And I think I can say that in some regards things are tougher now because I've had that confirmed by many grandparents that I've spoken to. I've often run into grandparents who have said, boy, I wouldn't want to be a parent in the 90s, you know. And so that even people that have been through it, I think have, even though we don't want to be naive and nostalgic about how life used to be, I think when it comes to the issue of looking for allies in the culture around us in our attempt to transmit certain values to our children, those allies, those organizational allies that we normally used to be able to count on in American culture simply aren't there to the same degree. As we see the stability of the culture around us seem to come apart at the edges, it becomes more and more a sense in which parents feel they are alone, and especially where Christian parents feel they are alone in having to contend with some pretty significant and formidable opposition in their attempt to instill certain values in their children. Just a quick poll initially to see, well, how many are parents with children at home presently? Raise your hand. Okay. Do we have any single parents present? Okay. And actually, that's about it for coverage. So most of you have children at home and are addressing this issue in your life. As I've mentioned, I'm a rather obsessive father, and I don't take credit for that because there's some real drawbacks to being an obsessive parent, as those of you who are obsessive know. And there's that tremendous risk of spoiling your kids rotten as they grow older. But I do love children, and I believe that when it comes to faith, kids have a great deal to teach us. And I'd like to begin this evening with sharing with you some insights I've learned either from reading but also from my own children about lessons that children have taught adults in this whole issue of values and faith. True story, a couple had just become parents for the second time, and they brought their new baby home. And their three-year-old child began making a very curious demand from the very first day that the new baby was brought home. And the demand was this. He said, "I really need to talk to the baby alone." Now, the child persisted in this request for months. And the parents were a little uneasy about this and just kind of kept putting the child off, assuming that the three-year-old really wasn't all that serious. But as the child's request persisted, "I really need to talk to the baby alone," the parents finally gave in, and they left their three-year-old with the baby in the nursery, but they left the monitor on. They had a baby monitor in there, and they closed the door. And this is what they heard in a very low whisper. The three-year-old spoke to the newborn and said, "Hurry up and tell me what God looks like. I'm starting to forget." And I thought, what a neat story about, kind of gives us a glimpse. This three-year-old, of course, had the impression that there was a vision of God that he had as a newborn, that as he was getting older, he was beginning to lose. And it kind of reminds me that there is that sense of the Creator, I think, that we can gain from children, that the transmission of values to children is not a one-way process, and that the nurturing of our children in faith is not a one-way process. It's really a dialogue, and there are a great many ways in which they can teach us. Another very interesting article I ran across was an article about atheistic parents that were trying to raise their children without any religious orientation. And one mother, who was a confessed atheist, in this article recalled a time that her three-year-old daughter had been given a Bible storybook by a friend of hers and insisted that her mom read from the Bible storybook to her for a bedtime story. And here's how the mom recounted, this mother, who is an atheist, recounted this story. She said, quote, "I opened the book and read the first story. Whoops, miracle number one. Jesus heals a lame man. And I said to my daughter, 'Listen, honey, this isn't how things work. It isn't true.' But as the reading went on and the miracles piled up and my protestations continued, my daughter, growing increasingly impatient with my protests, patted the page and said, 'Mommy, just read.'" And I thought again, an idea, kind of a neat example of how children can teach us a great deal. Kids also teach us about ourselves. There's the story about the two brothers who had a fight, and as the day passed on, there was no reconciliation in sight. And at bedtime, mother said, "Don't you think you should forgive your brother," to one of the boys, "before you go to sleep? Because the Bible says we should not let the sun go down on our anger." And the boy's response was, "But how can I keep the sun from going down?" And, of course, I continually, in the behavior of my boys, see myself reflected even in their less flattering moments. And, of course, I have to throw in some illustrations from my own family when it comes to theological insights from children. My four-year-old Trevor, after seeing a television program in which there were some particular sinister characters, was sitting at the counter when I was in the kitchen, and he said, "Dad, can God do anything?" And I said, "Well, yes, he can." And then Trevor said, "Well, then why are there bad guys?" And I was kind of ready for that one. I said, "Well, Trevor, usually bad people make the decision to be bad. God didn't make them that way." But I thought that was pretty good for a four-year-old. "If God can do anything, Dad, then why are there bad guys?" Or my son Colin, at the age of five, had an interesting insight into the ministry. He and my wife Sue were having a discussion about what he might want to be when he grows up. And he brought the issue up, and he said, "Mom, what should I be when I grow up?" And being a good reflective listener, Sue responded by saying, "Well, I don't know, what would you like to be?" And he said, "Maybe something easy, like a pastor." I obviously haven't been too much of a workaholic in his presence. Well, today we want to begin by appraising the challenges of parenting in this culture, in this decade, because I do think it's a little harder than it used to be. At least that's the opinion a lot of people are claiming. And by culture, I want to go over a number of cultural trends with you and discuss their implications. Some of these I got from Faith Popcorn, who is my favorite trends analyst. Faith Popcorn's original name was Plotkin. She changed to Popcorn because she's into marketing. But she's president of Brain Reserve Incorporated in New York City. And she works a lot in the business area, but as her business marketing work involves a lot of trends forecasting in terms of cultural trends. But a lot of other sources. Faith is only one of a number. And the first cultural trend I'd like to talk about is the increasing crime rate. Faith Popcorn put it this way. She said, for the first time ever in world history, the wilderness is now safer than civilization. Between 1960 and 1990, the violent crime rate in the United States increased 500%, 500% in 30 years. Between 1989 and 1994, more than 90,000 people were murdered in the United States. That's in 5 years. And this was almost twice as many as were killed in the Vietnam War in 8 years. So the murder rate is twice the death rate, casualty rate from Vietnam. A young black man living in Harlem is now less likely to live until the age of 40 than a young man living in Bangladesh. 20% of high school students now carry a firearm, knife, or some other weapon on a regular basis. In today's Seattle Post Intelligence, and I want you to know that my statistics are up to date, I got this from today's paper, it's just in the reading room, they've just reported now over a 4-year period an 80% increase in aggravated assaults by minors, by juveniles in the United States. And that's in 4 years, an 80% increase nationally. New York City, in 1943 in New York City, there were 44 homicides. Think about that. For the entire year in New York City, in 1943, only 44 homicides. In 1991, it was 1,499. And, you know, in terms of the crime, in my own personal experience, the church I served in Vista, California, we had a fellow who was in his 80s who was abducted, kidnapped, and murdered in daylight in a large suburban mall. We had a young 6-year-old Hispanic girl who was abducted from her front yard in broad daylight back in Vista, California. And I still remember the helicopters circling over the neighborhood hoping to find her immediately after her disappearance. I remember there was a false sighting of her in Louisiana, even though she had disappeared in California. And because of a sighting, supposed sighting in Louisiana, there was a nationwide FBI manhunt for her. But 1 year later, her body turned up just 15 miles away. She had been murdered apparently probably very soon after she had been abducted. Of course, we had the abduction of that young girl in north of San Francisco. What was her last name? Was it Polly? What was that? The girl that was abducted from her, from her slumber party, with friends around, and of course, which was particularly unnerving for a great many people. My niece was working her father's video store in North San Diego County just 2 weeks ago, and a video store, of course, carries a very small amount of cash. She was one of two teenage girls in there when, at 10:30 p.m., a man came in at gunpoint and forced them to give over the money. I mean, we're talking about a time now where for example, a parent whose teenager is entering the job market, you want to think twice about having any longer being in a situation where your child is working in something like a video store, like a convenience store, any place where they might be alone in the evening or with a small number of people. It's just it's really getting scary out there in terms of the crime trend. And the question then, of course, is in the context of what we're talking about, is what is the implication for parents? And I think the greatest implication here is that we are dealing in a time in which many of our children are being robbed of their childhood. In many urban areas now, parents no longer allow their children to play outside without an adult supervising. They can't play in the front anymore in those neighborhoods where drive-by shootings have become commonplace. And one of the greatest tragedies then for the crime rate is simply that sense. Newsweek magazine addressed this about 2 or 3 months back in a cover story. But that sense in which the crime rate, the worst implication of that of all is not the actual number of victims, is the fact that it's become prevalent enough now, and the media has even exaggerated it beyond reality to the point where there's that continual sense of fear, you know, the need that parents have to always give their kids instructions, you know, about, now if anybody comes and says they've come on my behalf, you know, to pick you up, if you don't know them, don't go with them. You know, all the precautions that we have to give our children, the concern about whether they're walking to school, and if so, whether that's safe. I still remember, I believe it was in Ohio, 3 8-year-old boys together as a threesome in broad daylight. And this was a community that was fairly near a major freeway. And these boys were abducted and murdered and by some teenagers that had some serious psychological problems. And there's certain ritualistic abuse involved before they were murdered. And I remember that what was kind of upsetting to my wife and myself was when we read that this isn't one child alone in broad daylight. This was three boys together, you know. And of course, there was that assumption just 20 or 30 years ago that that would be safe, you know, that you could do. Kids could be out together. Trend number two I'd like to talk about was the loss of heroes in American culture. Faith Popcorn says, "Now we can read about our role models in the scandal sheets or visit them in jail," unquote. People, of course, actually, I believe the two categories, the two primary hero categories now, are entertainment celebrities and sports celebrities. And to think that those are as good as the role models seem to get for a significant percentage of the American population. In many of the news accounts, noticing that for many people, the greatest shock, for those people that were really upset and depressed over O.J. Simpson's predicament, a number of them who were quoted in the newspaper, their depression had nothing to do with the fact that they cared about O.J. and what he might be going through at this point, and that perhaps thought he was innocent. A lot of the depression had to do with people who were so disillusioned that somebody that they had respected as much as O.J. Might in fact have done this. And then I thought to myself, well, why on earth had he been lifted on that kind of a pedestal? I mean, what had the man done? He won the Heisman Trophy. He was very good. He had a good but brief professional football career. And he was the Hertz spokesperson. I mean, I was trying to think now, what qualified this person to be the kind of role model where this kind of disillusionment would be the result of his supposed fall? Or Kurt Cobain, closer here to Holden Village, the rock star who committed suicide, and the news reports about that, and about that sense in which all these youth were grieving, and you felt that for many of them, this was as great a hero as they had in their lives. That was it. That's as high as it got for them. Kurt Cobain. And that he, in fact, was a role model for them. And here they were, as they were being quoted in news stories, there was that sense that some saint had died, and he was anything but. And of course, when you think about some of the implications of all of this, just to throw this statistic out, between 1960 and 1990, the teen suicide rate has increased 300%. You know, speaking of Kurt Cobain, 300% increase in 30 years in the teen suicide rate. Implication for parents in terms of this loss of appropriate heroes and role models is that we have fewer cultural allies in our attempt to model an appropriate values and an appropriate lifestyle to our children. It's very difficult to find people that we can point to who have achieved any kind of a public notoriety, who are being covered by the press, that people that most people know who they are and what they represent whenever their name is mentioned. It's becoming more and more difficult to have these people that we can point to as examples for our children. It's becoming more and more a question of the kind of modeling we can do in our own home with less and less assistance from the culture around us. Trend number three is economic insecurity. The loss of benefited jobs for many parents, the loss of stable lifetime employment, the GI generation, the retirement for the GI generation really seems to be about as good as it's going to get for any generation in the foreseeable future. And the economic forecasters are indicating that from this point on, future generations as they reach retirement is going to become more difficult. And so there's real concern for the retirement of the parents today, but also even more so, of course, for what the future looks like for their children. There's the cost of college and tuition, and how quickly that college tuition rates are going up so much faster than the inflation rate. It's just tragic. There's the situation in terms of the economy where corporations are shifting to temporary, expendable employees, and we begin to wonder about the job market as our kids enter that as they become young adults. An implication for parents is our kids are growing up very anxious. They're growing up very anxious. Call this a coincidence, I don't know, but our six-year-old Colin had a homework assignment. He was supposed to use the word job, J-O-B, and the first sentence he thought of is, I can't find a job. Now, neither of his parents have had that struggle recently, but I really get the impression sometimes in the kinds of conversation topics that I hear happening in my own household, that there is that sense that there's not a whole lot of economic security out there. And the children are beginning to pick up on that from a fairly young age. And in my own generation, the baby boomers, you know, one thing with all of the chaos and confusion of the 60s, one thing that was almost always taken for granted was that if you really wanted a job and you were willing to work for it, you'd get it. And you could count, you know, this of course assuming you were a middle class American, but that you could count on stable employment as part of your future. And more and more people, of course, that are realizing that that assumption is no longer a valid one. Trend number four, the environmental crisis. We have a situation now, of course, in our world where a forested area the size of the country of Austria is being cut down annually. Cut down annually. In terms of old growth forests. The population growth problem is scary. Of course, the immediate one that my kids are always aware of is the ozone layer, because we're all just bending over backwards to get out that sunblock. And so often when that comes up in discussion, or when we have to be so careful to make sure every exposed inch of their body is covered, I reflect nostalgically back in my own adolescence. Where, of course, there was some damage we weren't aware of, but we know now, of course, that it was a lot safer to go out in the sun in 1968 than it is now. And it's so sad to see how things have changed. You know, just that's one, perhaps, the question, of course, of how much worse that's going to get in the near future, but even now, it's pretty sad. The implication for parents in terms of the environment around us and the implication for our children is that we have responsibility to ensure that our kids are part of the solution in the future and not part of the problem. One thing I really want to mention to you on this environmental issue is that we have to be very careful not to be too fatalistic in front of our children when it comes to discussions about the environment. It is very easy to give up. It's very easy to give up. And we have to always remind ourselves of how quickly and how easily our children pick up on our fatalism. And what we rob them of when we do that is we rob them of hope. It's very easy for me on a very practical level to sit down and to read a few articles on the deteriorating environment around me and to think to myself, I thank God I'm not going to live beyond, you know, whatever the year is. And then I have to realize, oh my word, but my children are still going to be here. And we have to be so careful not to speak in a way that brings them to a point of despair when it comes to the future of the environment. Because if our world is just filled with people that have given up, then there truly is no hope. Trend number five is the trend that is identified by Faith Popcorn as 99 lives, or the frenzy factor. No time to meet all of our obligations. There is now significantly less leisure time for the average American family than back in the 1960s. And what about the computer age? Has the computer age helped? No, not at all. The information highway has become one more form of gridlock in our lives. It has simply given us the opportunity to perhaps be more productive, but in fact has limited our leisure time. Well, there is now a daytimer calendar book that you can buy that has 24 hourly appointment times per day. I mean, think about that. I mean, you can now buy a day timer to set appointments at any given hour of the day. An implication for parents in terms of the frenzy factor is the challenge of making time for our children. And we're going to spend some more time on that later in the week. But that is more difficult than ever, but it's more urgent than ever. There is no single more meaningful way in which you can indicate your love to your children than to make time for them. there's absolutely nothing else you can do that will compare in terms of its benefit to your children than simply making time for them. And in many families, it is no longer valid to simply say it's an issue of quality and not quantity. Because in many families, the quantity has become so low that it's begun to directly reflect the quality of the relationship. That there are many households now where the parents simply have to make more time, one way or another. Trend number six, the collapse of the traditional family and how that has complicated lives for so many children. All the children, of course, that have to contend with divorce situations in their household. It's now projected that 2 out of 3 marriages that take place this year will fail. And there is the leaving, in addition to the divorce, there is the leaving of the extended family situation. The fact that in addition to so many nuclear families having a difficult time staying together, we have the fact that fewer and fewer people are living in the same close geographical proximity to their extended family. So we often have situations now where the nuclear family does not have an extended family to fall back on. It's in the other end of the country. And the mobility rate in our culture has of course, the primary culprit in that situation. We have, of course, many, many alternative family models out there that, in many cases, do nothing to assure the commitment of the parents to each other in marriage. The cohabiting couples, listen to this statistic. In 1970, there were 500,000 cohabiting couples in this country who were living together outside of marriage. 20 years later, it's 5 times that many, 2.5 million. And of course, we know that many of those households are situations where the children are aware of a continual turnover. Typically, of course, it's mom's the primary caregiver, and in many cases, boyfriend after boyfriend is just passing through the lives of those children. And one thing we have to take very seriously, too, in the case of daughters, is when boyfriends come into the household to live, there is a significant increased risk of abuse from a male figure who is not physically related to a daughter. Much more likely to be abused in that situation than when it's the actual birth father. Illegitimate births in this country are up 300% over the last 30 years. 300%. At this point now, 1 in every 4 births in the United States, 1 in every 4 births is outside of marriage. In 1 million homes in the United States, children are now being raised by grandparents as primary caregivers. 1 million homes. The majority of those homes, we are talking about mothers that have simply not been able to follow through. Pardon me, we're talking about mothers and fathers. And, you know, one thing I remember just vividly is Bill Moyers' story on the documentary many years ago when there was a young man that he interviewed who was a father of, he was father of 6 different children by 3 different women. And Bill Moyers rather naively asked him if it, he never married any of these women. He naively asked this young man if he had any scruples or any problems with his conscience with this situation that he had fathered 6 children by 3 different women. And his response was, quote, no, I'm not gonna let any woman spoil my life. We have just epidemic proportions in terms of situations such as that, where women are being left alone to parent their children. Trend number 7, life and love in the AIDS era. Life and love in the AIDS era. Talk about something kids are growing up scared about. It's AIDS. But that doesn't mean, unfortunately, they're not having sex at a very young age. They're having sex anyway. In 1993, AIDS cases in the United States increased 111%. 111%. And the greatest percentage increase in terms of all constituencies was among teen and young adults, teens and young adults, mostly through heterosexual transmission, not homosexual, heterosexual. So the groups that are increasing in terms of the percentage that have AIDS at the fastest rate are teenagers and young adults through heterosexual relationships. And is our hope at that point, of course, condoms? Well, the Center for Disease Control indicates that the failure rate for condoms now for HIV transmission is 30%. 30%. Much better for birth control than that, but for HIV transmission, the failure rate now is 30% for condoms. You begin to wonder, you know, if you were a skydiver, if you'd parachute with those kinds of odds. In 1988, 26% of 15-year-old girls admitted to being sexually active. Back in 1988, 26% of 15-year-old girls admitted to being sexually active. And that compared to only 5% back in 1970. Now, many of those persons in 1970 were sexually active and wouldn't admit it. But nevertheless, remember 1970. That was already kind of a quote, a very free time. And that is at least reflective of an increased level of sexual promiscuity among teens, despite the fact that AIDS is now here. I read when I was in Washington, D.C. airport a few months back on teenagers in the Washington, D.C. area, both urban and suburban, that had been interviewed about their sexual lifestyles. And here's a quote from that article. First of all, the premise of the article was that teenagers are as sexually active, if not more, than ever before. But one young man, a 17-year-old named Eugene, who was identified in this article as a serial monogamist. You ever heard that term? He was identified as a serial monogamist, which apparently means that he has one girlfriend at a time, but he has multiple girlfriends over a period of, you know, a year. But he's not promiscuous. He's a serial monogamist because he goes steady and then has intimate sexual relations. Anyway, Eugene was interviewed about this issue of being tested for AIDS. And Eugene, a 17-year-old, said that he gets tested for AIDS every 3 months. Each time, getting test results involves the same routine. As he bounds up the steps to the clinic, his palms sweat, his heart gallops. He fidgets as he waits for his doctor, and then when he learns he has tested negative, he continues to have sex without protection, unquote. You know, you think about the teen sense of immortality, of course, is one of the big challenges here, is that sense that what comes with youth often is the sense, well, it couldn't happen to me. And here's Eugene here is a classic example. And he acknowledges that that doesn't make sense, that he's being impractical, this is not a wise way to do things, and yet he continues to have unprotected sex regardless. Implication for parents in terms of raising children in the era of AIDS, of course, is that sex education has become a life and death matter. And we, of course, are going to have to do more than simply leave it to the schools, given what the risks that are involved. And I have to admit that, of course, generally speaking, simply by virtue of becoming a parent, I become more conservative in many areas in my life. But I'll tell you, AIDS has made me extremely conservative when it comes to the issue of sexual ethics in my children. But the problem, we have to have communication lines open. And those communication lines have to be established prior to the time that our children are tempted. Ideally, we've just got to get those lines have to be open at a very, very young age so that we can at least keep tabs on what's going on. And do whatever we can, of course, to influence our children to a point where they can, seriously and with some real chance for success, consider abstinence as a real option for themselves in their teen years. Trend number 7, the advent of a value-free public education. Interesting little, I think a lot of you perhaps heard this, it's a favorite illustration by some authors. Over the years, American teachers have been asked to identify the top problems in American public schools. In 1940, teachers identified talking out of turn, chewing gum, making noise, running in the halls, cutting in line, dress code infractions, and littering. When asked the same question in 1990, teachers identified drug abuse, alcohol abuse, pregnancy, suicide, rape, robbery, and assault. And what's happening in the typical school, of course, is extremely unnerving to a great many parents. Many high schools, including Hollywood High School, for example, every student every day enters campus through a metal detector. And it is essential in that school, in many schools. Implication for parents in terms of what's happening on campuses is that ethics and faith will have to be taught more and more at home, because we simply cannot count upon significant allies at the school. In many schools, and this includes a great many suburban schools, it's not just inner city, in many schools, things have come to a point of such chaos that teachers have their hands full just trying to keep any semblance of order. And again, just one more way in which more and more responsibility is being passed back to the parents, whether they like it or not. Okay, we're going to have to figure out, considering all these trends that I've mentioned to you, we're going to have to start figuring out ways in which, as parents in our own households and through our churches, ways in which we can try to address some of the greater challenges that are part of parenting in the 90s. And in our time together this week, I'm going to be counting on a lot of assistance from people that show up to class in terms of asking for input in particular on this whole matter of the transmission of values to your children. And we're going to be doing some discussion of that whole question of ways in which you have found helpful to communicate with and to teach your children on the whole area of values in general, and Christian values in particular. I mean, not just Christian values, but to look at both of those areas. And I think that always the greatest teachers, of course, are parents that have already had experience, either have already been through it or are in the midst of it, and have learned some things over the years as they've fumbled and stumbled, as I often do, in trying to do the best that they can do for their kids. And I'd like to kind of spend the rest of our time this evening by having some discussion on the question of your family of origin. Now, I believe that we tend to either emulate our parents when we ourselves become parents, or we tend to overcompensate in our attempt to not repeat the mistakes that we're convinced that our parents made with us. And we often, we're somewhere along that scale, you know. For example, if you made it a scale from 1 to 10, and 1 on that scale was that you thought your parents were complete failures. And so as a result, you tended as a parent to try to do everything exactly the opposite of the way your parents did it, so that you would not repeat these mistakes you're convinced your parents would made. Or if you imagine that 10 on that scale was that you thought that your parents were absolute saints, and if you could simply successfully do about half of what your parents were able to accomplish, then you would be very happy with yourself in the raising of your own children. And of course, all of us are someplace in between that 1 and that 10. But I think for many of us, it's possible to actually put ourselves on that scale and to perhaps admit to ourselves whether we lean towards trying to compensate for the mistakes our parents made, or whether we lean towards really identifying in a very positive way with what our parents did and trying to emulate that. So considering your family of origin, in particular though, your parents, and the way that your parents raised you, I'd like to have a little input now on the issue of values and ask you this question. What do you want to pass on from your parents and your extended family to your children? In other words, what was conveyed or taught or modeled for you as you were raised as a child that you think that it's very important to convey to your own children or grandchildren by virtue of you having been fortunate enough to have received this yourself during your upbringing? And what I'm going to do is just to get kind of a list of some ideas that you share. And this will give us a sense for some of the values that we see that are important, that we believe we were fortunate enough to be taught in our own childhood, that we might want to carry on to the next generation. Who wants to start? Any kind of value or type of behavior that you had in your own upbringing that you think or it's important to carry on to future generations? Yes.
I think my mother taught me that the kids in the family was the most important thing, and that's the thing that I wanted to pass on my kids. That they were the most important. That this was her responsibility, and this was her job, and she was going to do it.
Okay, for your mother then, that the children were the most important thing in her life. Her children were the most important.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I felt that. And that's...
Now, when you say, am I hearing, when you say that, am I hearing, and this is just a punch on my part, am I hearing a certain disappointment with those households where children sense that career comes before the kids, or that some leisure comes before the kids, or whatever it is? Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of your own personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But so a sense in your own household that the children were the most important thing in your mother's life. What did you get from your father? Was that different than what
no,
you got from your mother?
Basically the same.
Okay, so you got it from both.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. You know, there's one stereotype operating. Tomorrow we're going to be discussing what's unique about boomers and busters as parents. And one interesting characterization, of course, all generalizations are to some degree faulty, but one generalization that's out there is that most boomers were raised with fathers who saw themselves primarily as breadwinners and tended not to be thought of as terribly nurturing. And so, and also that most boomers saw their mother as a primary nurturing individual in the household, very much unlike their fathers. And so it's interesting that in your household, at least, you felt that both father and mother
had... We never went any place. I mean, my mother and dad never went any place really by themselves.
Okay.
I mean, it was a family.
No couple time. It was always family.
Yeah.
Okay.
Always.
All right. Anybody else?
Good or bad.
Yes.
Love and appreciation for others.
Okay. Love and appreciation for others. Now, did you feel that was more taught than modeled, or both equally? Both modeled and taught, or?
Both modeled and
taught.
But not saying you have to love and you have to appreciate. Just by modeling most.
Mostly modeled.
You got this message.
Right. That's great. Can you think of one example of a kind of, in terms of their relationship with neighbors, you mean, for example, or?
With everything in life.
Okay.
Just truly appreciate others, to get along and to show love.
Okay. Great. Thank you. There are other hands. Yes?
Care for their parents in their later years.
Okay. So I have a vested interest in that. I like that. Okay. So, care for their parents. Okay. And of course, one more generalization that's being made in our culture is that the trend is towards more and more families that are not taking responsibility for their parents as they age. The assumption being that they're more likely to be institutionalized than used to be the case, at least. Yes?
Having a sense of responsibility for your own actions.
Okay, sense of responsibility. Boy, none of these are in good shape. All right, responsibility for your own actions. Yes?
The Christian faith is the most important thing in life. The church was number one priority in our family, in our lives.
Okay. So one very important part of the transmission of the faith was that it was made clear that the church is important. Okay. All right. Yes?
Madam Christian, I put it, home was a refuge. Home was some place you could come back to and lick your wounds.
Okay.
No matter how stupid or foolish you had been, I knew I could come home and I wouldn't be ridiculed for it.
Yeah.
I always had that, I mean, the stupider, right. But I could always come home and they wouldn't come down on you for,
right.
I could come home and lick my wounds. I always thought of it in terms of that.
How many of you live in a metropolitan setting, either suburban or a city? Okay, majority of you. I really feel that life in a metropolitan setting tends to contribute to an insecurity of a child by virtue of the lack of support groups that you find in that it's so much easier to feel part of communities, whether it's in terms of groups or the larger town, if you're in a small, either rural setting or a small town setting. And it's so much more of a challenge in a metropolitan setting to find the kinds of support groups, the kinds of networks that feed the self-esteem of the child. And so I think metropolitan lifestyle overall tends to feed a sense of insecurity and to make that concept of the home as a refuge even more urgent than perhaps it would be in a more rural setting. I'm not trying to paint rural life as idyllic, don't get me wrong, but I do believe that urban life is not helpful in this regard. Are there other hands? Any other values? Yes?
There's something that's kind of a variation of this. Something my uncle said, he said that people in from their early 20s to their mid-60s are living what he calls the middle ages, and their purpose is to help out those that are younger and older.
Okay, so that's one value you felt you were taught, was that for the importance of teaching the young. Okay. Oh. All right, anybody else? Yes.
Integrity.
Integrity, okay. Now, when you think of integrity, what comes to your mind?
Sticking to what you feel is right, even if there are short-term consequences that are substantial.
Okay, good.
Losing a job rather than compromising your principles.
Right.
Telling the truth even when it gets you in trouble.
Right. Now, I assume most of you are, how many of you attend church fairly regularly? Okay, that's what I thought. Second question, how many of you feel that your church, and I'm not going to ask you about your church's name, okay, so you can be honest about this. How many of you feel your church is doing an effective job in assisting you with your children? In terms of children's ministry at your congregation. Is that it? Okay. Now that's interesting. That's pretty depressing. So only a couple of you raised your hand and felt your church is doing an effective job in terms of helping. You're going to change your vote?
Our children are... The reason I didn't raise my hand is because my children are no longer at home.
Okay.
That's the only reason I raised.
Okay. So when they were young, you felt that the church did do it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Same with you. Okay, so many of it's the age of your children. Okay, so so a sense in which the older the kids get, the more ineffective the church becomes, or the more challenging it is for the church to do an effective job.
Change of pastors, change of all kinds of things, you know. I just thought they were super good when our children were growing up.
Yeah. Okay.
I have to admit, one reason I don't attend is because that seemed to be more clouding the issues with me than helping me.
Okay, clouding how?
Well, I'm sick as in a hole. I got into trouble when I started teaching Sunday school, and I couldn't spew back these stories that I had heard anymore. Okay. With the same old guilt trips and the same old guilt trips.
Well, how'd you get into trouble? I mean, because you weren't doing the lessons as given to you?
Yeah, and I can't do this anymore. They didn't make sense to me as a child. They don't make sense to me as a in confirmation. And I finally, as an adult, said, no, I do not agree with these Old Testament stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
And you weren't given the leeway as a teacher to change the content.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, here's one thing I can speak with, I think, plenty of experience on, is I get around the country when it comes to, and I see a lot of examples of what churches are and are not doing for children. And I think that I really believe that the typical congregation, typical ELCA church, has got a far, far better job with younger generations than it's doing. And I just get really irritated as a parent. And now I'm going to a church where I'm not pastor because I'm working outside. I'm working for the National Church. And so for the first time now since I've been ordained, I see all of this from the perspective of the person in the pew. And it's just really convicted me about this whole issue of how negligent most churches are in helping us with this whole issue of our children, the transmission of values, and primarily the church doing a good job about it. You know, the church is, church is quick to throw out what the values should be and try to teach the appropriate lessons, but the church is so incompetent in many cases to do it in a way in which children respond. And when you think of it, the culture that we live in and all the stimuli that the kids encounter, and of course their orientation towards entertainment, and how easy it is for them to be bored out of their heads. And the typical church, of course, just bores our kids silly. And we've got to find some more creative ways. And the frustration here is that there are congregations that do an effective job with children. And part of it is simply to put kids at a higher priority. We tend to have congregations, let's take, for example, worship. We tend to have congregations where worship is strictly an adult experience. And yet we expect kids to sit through 60 minutes of it. Sit through 60 minutes where we've got a token 3-minute children's sermon that often is so completely inane, the kids wonder why they bothered to go up front for it. And that's it, out of 60 minutes. Think from the perspective of small children. Do you realize that every time you stand in church, a small child is completely cut off visually from everything that's happening up front? Do you realize that almost all the music that you sing is music that really is for adults and for not kids? Do you realize that it's almost impossible for a pastor to have the gift of preaching a sermon that is equally meaningful for a 35-year-old and an 8-year-old? I mean, we've got to start understanding how important this task is of the church being involved as an effective ally to the Christian parent in helping their children learn values and to learn about the faith. And we are just doing an abysmal job at it. It's like many institutions. We tend to defer to people that are paying the bills, and the 8-year-old isn't paying the bills. And there's this sense in which we're always deferring to adults. We simply need more help from the church on that. And I don't want to get into ideas. I've got plenty. But the fact is, there are lots of churches out there that are taking this more seriously than they are. Matter of fact, there are lots of churches out there that are growing simply because they've convinced parents in the community that helping them raise their children is that church's number one priority. And then they've indicated that, they've lived that, they've modeled that by virtue of where they put their resources. They bend over backwards to have quality programs and ministries for children and for parents attempting to raise those children. Anybody else on values that you didn't get a chance to get up on the list?
On the third one, I'd like to add respect, love and respect and appreciation for others.
All right, home is a refuge. And children, of course, when you think of refuge now, especially for people living in the city in high crime areas, boy, is that a desperate need. Children is the most important thing in a parent's life. And, you know, that book... That book, Habits of the Heart, which has, of course, become a sociological classic, where it talks about, for middle-class Americans, some cultural trends in terms of their values. And one thing that really came out of that book is that whole concept of a radical kind of individualism in American culture, which is the idea that adults are out for fulfillment, and that self-fulfillment is the key. We live in a culture where the whole narcissistic focus is on the idea that I live my life for my total enjoyment, my self-actualization. And we even have the New Age movement to kind of feed this with the idea of enlightenment, self-actualization, the whole concept that we are out for the self. And the challenge to be part of that kind of culture and expect that the children who have been raised to believe that the primary thing in life is for their own personal self-fulfillment, take those children, and those children then become parents themselves. And then, of course, that really complicates the challenge of trying to transmit that value to their own children. They become very irresponsible parents. And so we are contending with this trend in our culture as far as values towards increasing self-centeredness at the same time that what kids need more than anything else is parents that are willing to say, you actually come before my own personal needs. Love and appreciation and respect for other people, of course, is a very important value as part of the Christian faith. Care for their parents in later years, a sense of family, a responsibility to family, a sense of responsibility for their own actions. You know, as a rather obsessive father, one of the most justifiable criticisms of my own parenting is the fact that I tend to relate to my children too much on the level of immediate gratification, which means that I want my kids to like me. I want my kids to show me how much they like me. And so I tend to not insist as often as I should on the kind of behavior that is for their long-term benefit, even because I don't like being put in the situation of not being liked as their parent. And I think I'm very common. I think I'm very typical among people in my own generation. There are far too many of us that are approaching parenting as if it's a popularity contest. And in the same way in which we felt a significant generation gap with our own parents, our new model in life is the fact that we'll never have that generation gap with our kids, right? So we see examples of parents all over the place bending over backwards to, quote, relate to their kids, right? We have these things working for us, like our kids are watching the same sitcom reruns that were being produced back when we were kids. Right now that we have Nickelodeon, you know, we all know the same, we know Mr. Ed and Leave It to Beaver and Beverly Hillbillies. We listen to similar style of music, right? We often watch similar types of programs. All these ways in which culture is helping us bridge any potential generation gap. And a lot of us are really enjoying being able to always relate to our kids as if we're kids ourselves. Well, where that falls down is the transmission of values, is that falls down when it comes to discipline, that falls down when it comes to teaching responsibility toward other people. It falls down in any way in which we are trying to set standards for our children so they themselves can become responsible adults. And I think it's a very important thing that has to be looked at. We tend to spoil them rotten. In many households, that's becoming very much the story. The Christian faith is the most important in the church, and of course our challenge. I'll tell you, I'm my feeling on this one, if you sense that you're in a church that's not doing what it could be doing for your kids, and you make your honest attempt to try to get the church to consider, of course, we have to assume now that you're in a church where there are other families that have similar age children to yours, so you wouldn't be the only family that would have this concern. And you sense your church is unresponsive to that, I would encourage you to leave your church and find a church that takes this more seriously. Because I honestly believe that that this is one of the most important roles the church has. And if the church is deliberately ignoring the needs of families when it comes to their children, whatever their age, then that church needs to go ahead and pay the consequences for that, because that's just a very, very important role that the church has to play. And we live in a society now where it used to be that we could count upon the school to help in this whole issue of values transmission. And we used to be able to count to some degree if the culture is at large to affirm some of those values that we were trying to teach our children. And that is simply not as true as it once was. And as a result, we need the church more than ever when it comes to this whole issue of the transmission of values.
I'm not real aware of the situation in our church, but I know there is a group of parents of children, probably less than teenage, that meet regularly about parenting. And I know they've tried to encourage more people to come, and they have an awful time
getting people out
yeah. to be interested in that.
That's program. Interesting. Well, a lot of churches have parent support groups. That's becoming fairly common.
That's a real close-knit group. You can see it's great things are happening with these children in the congregation because of the parents.
Is that right? Well, you know, one of the easiest bonds to establish is parent-to-parent if they have similar age children. It's one of the easiest types of small groups to birth because they have so much in common and plenty to talk about. And my suggestion would be most churches that have a problem once a group is already established, that simply means they need to start a second group. Because new people tend to be very reluctant to join a group that's already been together for a while. They find it difficult to break in. And so a small group dynamic is so intimate that a small group tends to cement its relationships very quickly. According to many people, including myself, my feeling is that once a small group has been in existence for 6 months, it no longer has any outreach potential at all. And you need to start another small group. You need to regularly start new small groups. New people need new groups. They do not normally join pre-existing groups. And the smaller a group, the more true that is. So there's probably a need for a second parenting group. And all you need is like one couple from the present group to say, we're willing to leave this group and to birth a new one. Or we're willing to go to both to help make the new one happen. Okay, well, thanks very much. We're about that time. So tomorrow's going to be Boomers and Busters. And we are that time, right? Yeah, 17. Boomers and Busters, and what's kind of unique about how these generations are approaching the whole parenting challenge, and how that's both good and bad. Okay, thank you. Thank you.